Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events, and we bring you selections of those panels in a weekly review show on Saturday mornings. On Tuesday, April 16th, Joe was joined by diplomat-in-residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
The trial of Donald Trump started yesterday, and it was a rousing success. They did not pick a single juror, and that was what they were there for yesterday, was to jury selection. Well, that didn't happen. And while he faces charges that he falsified business records to cover up a sex scandal while serving as president, more than half of the first group of prospective jurors was dismissed almost immediately for a variety of reasons. Now, as far as let us remember that Mr. Trump faces 34 felony counts and could face probation or up to 4 years of prison time. The trial is expected to last weeks. That's when it actually gets underway, because first, a jury must be selected, a winnowing that began Friday. There's a couple takeaways that the New York Times published that I thought are interesting, just to maybe start off on the conversation. Justice Merchant, a veteran New York jurist, is no nonsense. That hasn't favored the defense. He's been consistent about batting back defense motions on issues including the tardy disclosure of documents by prosecutors and efforts to delay or even dismiss the case. Also, the trial is about much more than business records. Justice Merchant's decision on Monday made it clear that the trial will resurface unsavory events in the former president's life. Those include the Access Hollywood tape and other stories that Mr. Trump sought to suppress, including an alleged affair with Ms. McDougal. And Justice Merchant said on Monday that both could be discussed. Meanwhile, Trump says he's happy, although his demeanor suggests otherwise. Entering the courtroom, he said he was very proud to be there. Once he was in front of Mr. Merchant, Trump looked a lot less enthusiastic. He slouched, he scowled, he scoffed, and he was quiet. Not the norm for a man who has built a political career with his gift for slashing attacks and vicious put-downs. And yes, at one point before lunch, he appeared to fall asleep. The trial may take a while. That's another takeaway. It's easy to forget how long it takes to do a little in legal settings. On Monday, the morning session was dominated by maneuvering by prosecutors and the defense, even as prospective jurors waited. By lunch, they were still waiting. Jury selection could take days or weeks, and the trial itself may take months. The Passover holiday could cause delays, Justice Merchant said, though he might make some of that up by holding hearings on court matters on Wednesdays, which previously was going to be an off day. And so now, as of yesterday afternoon, prospective jurors finally made their way into the courtroom. The judge welcomed them, introduced the lawyers and Mr. Trump, and read them a summary of the case. And these are the questions he asks, and if anyone has ever served in a jury knows these very well. Can you be fair and impartial, especially to the former president? Of the 96 prospective jurors in the room at the time, more than 50 raised their hands. They were immediately excused. The remaining jurors were asked 42 questions. By the end of Monday, 11 jurors had been questioned and two more were excused. A woman who said she could not be fair and a man who said his child's wedding date could conflict with the trial were both let off. And then to round it all out, Trump spoke briefly to TV cameras after court adjourned, and he called this, he's doing something new now, he called it a political witch hunt.
Oh, wow, yeah. I never heard those words.
Yep. And then he went to the motorcade and went off, and I assume we'll be back at the courthouse today. All right. Judy.
So I understand the intense media coverage yesterday. There was a lot of it. It was almost relentless. And as someone who as a reporter sat through a lot of jury selection, it can be fairly interesting because both sides kind of lay out their cases. They interview witnesses. They haven't gotten to that point. Be interesting to see what happens today because this can quickly grind down to boring. I can almost understand Donald Trump nodding off. It's interesting that at the end of the day, one of the top things the Trump team tried to dispel or to counter was the idea that he had fallen asleep. He had not fallen asleep, as people say. People misinterpreted that. But people who saw it in the courtroom seemed to think his mouth went slack. He had that jerk you get when you're sitting up and you realize you're asleep. So I can understand he might have fallen asleep. There's one thing people should understand here, though. Democrats and people who are against Donald Trump are breathlessly waiting for this trial. There is a possibility that he will be acquitted, and that will only bolster his chances for re-election. I don't think that's talked about enough. People who are clamoring for these trials to go forward, there's a chance that he could be, that they could get a hung jury, they could get a jury that fails to convict. So that would be even better for him.
My first thought when I saw that they didn't pick any jurors was I was kind of encouraged by it, that people are answering honestly. And the next thought that occurred to me is as soon as jurors start getting picked, Donald Trump is going to say they're dishonest. If that's not a violation of his gag order, if it is, and he doesn't care, I don't know. It's encouraging to know that people are willing to go into court and say, no, I can't be objective, which is kind of the opposite of a rigged system, that, it would be liberals clamoring to get into court and walking in and going, oh, no, I could judge this just fine. I'll find him guilty through all the evidence for sure. It's an encouraging thing to see that people are being honest, although it wouldn't be the first time people were dishonest to get out of jury duty either. So the falling asleep thing is interesting in as much as I think he is losing sleep over this. I think the bubble that he lives in, and he's got, there's basically two Trump bubbles. There's the bubble of the, like the fake election where I think he really believes he was robbed of an election, but he's also been able to convince half the country that it was a stolen election. And then there's the other bubble that Trump lives in that he tries to create when he says things like, essentially, I think what's happened in recent months is that Donald Trump, bubbles are kind of bursting all around him. And they're doing it particularly in courts of law. He lost the E. Jean Carroll case, and he's on the hook for $84 million, and he lost the fraud case that the attorney general brought against him, and he's on the hook for $460-something million. And everywhere he's turning, he's finding that the court system is treating him like a defendant, whether it's a civil defendant or, in this case, a criminal defendant. He got a few reminders of that. Very stark ones in this trial, in the last few days, where the judge said, no, you can't go to Washington to go listen to the Supreme Court on a case you don't have to by law be at, but by law you have to be in my courtroom. And so you're going to be in my courtroom. And he's just learning you can't go to your son's graduation, next month. We're not going to play that game. We're not going to play these games to delay things. And I think it's hitting home for him that he could come out of this trial. He could be exonerated, no question. But I think it's also hitting home for him that he could come out of this trial with a criminal conviction. And then where that goes, the one thing he is certain of at this point is it's not a game anymore. Right. And he's out of control. He's not in control. Well, he's out of control, but more importantly, he's not in control. The judge is in control.
Yeah, and either way, I mean, it'll prove to be beneficial money-wise in bringing in campaign contributions. Mm-hmm. But what does that mean? I assume then you appeal and then we're back to the races, right?
But he's also looking at the big money, to catch up with Biden. There was a story about that as well, that, little donations, he's drained his little donors, I think. And he's trying to catch up to Biden with big donors. And I'm not sure that big donors are quite as what?
Gullible?
Gullible, yeah, that's the word. you know, there's a few out there. I think my pillow guy probably is one of them. but I'm not so sure the well is going to dry up. The big wells are going to dry up, or some of them anyway.
Jim?
Well, since the theme so far has been sleeping in courtrooms, I was on jury duty last summer, and it was really fascinating to be part of the jury selection process. And near the beginning of the process, one person announced that they had narcolepsy, and therefore they couldn't be on the jury. And so they were dismissed. And then several other people said, oh, wait, I have narcolepsy too. And
I want to see a doctor's note.
Yeah. You know, they were dismissed also, and I had the distinct feeling, the judge didn't say it, but I had the distinct feeling that the judge was thinking they might be honest, they might not be honest about this, but if they're not honest about this, I don't want them on this trial. Right. It was a very tough and sensitive trial, and it was interesting to see the process by which it's winnowed down. I think selecting a jury for this case, it just started because I think there's really no political middle left in the country, and people have either decided they're all for him or they're all against him politically. So how that overlaps into being impartial in terms of a criminal proceeding, I think that's a very tough thing. And then the safety of the jurors once the trial starts. I mean, we have seen, you know, real very serious threats against all kinds of people. Secretaries of state and states who oversee elections and people who are election workers and on and on and on. And I think no matter what is done to probably protect the identities of the jurors, they're likely to really be in the bullseye. And I think they're going to be doing their civic duty and more. I also just want to follow up on one thing that Judy said and Jay alluded to as well, and the idea that he might be exonerated. And that, you know, there are many people who oppose Donald Trump who are really hoping that this is the way we can rid him of the body politic. And I think that's I think the criminal justice process should take its course and let the chips fall where they may. But in terms of the health of our political institutions, I think counting on the courts to do political work is a mistake. And I think if we want to have an election that is seen as legitimate and that doesn't send the country down a very dangerous road of post-election day violence, I think we need to see an election where one person wins clearly and the other person doesn't, and let those chips fall where they may. Because if...
Well, we had that 4 years ago and it didn't work.
Yeah, but we have to have it again. And I think to have the courts intercede, you know, I've seen this kind of game played out, and I say game in terms of the politics of it, and I'm not commenting on the court, but I've seen it played out in other countries, particularly in African countries, where candidates are bounced off the ballot. This was even the case in Egypt when I was living there many years ago for the first elections after the revolution. And it delegitimizes the ultimate outcome of the election, one way or another. And so as much as opponents of Trump might be waiting with bated breath for one or many of these cases to somehow take him out of the election or to tarnish him so much that he's not a viable candidate anymore, I'm sure there's going to be many people who write in and disagree with me, but I just don't think that's healthy for our election process.
Jim Ketterer on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, April 16th. We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, April 18th, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association Judy Patrick, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
Speaker Johnson moves on foreign aid, possibly triggering vote to oust him. The speaker has introduced a complex five-part plan requiring separate four votes on Israel and Ukraine, as well as standalone legislation. And it's a separate vote on border security that was intensified to mollify hard right members. Two things. One, I love the word mollify. Two, it isn't easy to mollify the Republican hard right members in the House of Representatives. So instead of this plan that he floated this week, Johnson now intends to try to pass five bills, not four, one each for aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Indo-Pacific allies, as well as GOP wish list of foreign policy priorities and a fifth standalone bill to address widespread Republican demands to strengthen the southern U.S. border. GOP leadership announced that the House would stay in session until Saturday to consider the bills. The new approach is risky and is already blowing up on the speaker, whose six-month hold on the gavel is being threatened by a promise by Marjorie Taylor Greene to invoke, quote, motion to vacate, to topple Johnson, if he puts Ukraine aid on the floor, something to which many hard-right Republicans object. Teresa.
This is ridiculous. I'm sorry.
We'll start with that.
So first of all, Congress needed to pass a package of aid for Israel, humanitarian aid for Gaza, the Philippines, the whole package a long, long time ago. But these Republicans said, well, no, you can't do that without border security. So they spent months working to put together a border security package with Republicans, Senator Lankford and others. It was all set to go to the floor. Then former President Trump signals, oh, no, 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 we don't want that. And so blows up the border security bill. So then the Senate passes a package. Well, bottom line is, the House should just take up the Senate's package and pass it. There are votes, enough votes in the House to do that. The world is watching. The world is on fire. Ukraine needs the funding. Israel needs the funding. As best I know, there isn't the humanitarian funding for Gaza in this package. And now they've added a TikTok provision. There are the votes in the House to do this. Put it on the floor. Let's see what Marjorie Taylor Greene does or doesn't do. But the security of the U.S. and the security of the world should not rest in her hands. And it's really a problem.
At any point.
At any point, on any issue. And if these members of Congress didn't learn enough by what, you know, went on in the Middle East in the last few weeks, they are not doing their jobs. Just bring a package to the floor for a vote. The wisest, best, most expedient thing to do is bring the package that's already passed the Senate so that they can get it to the president's desk. The Secretary of Defense was testifying yesterday about the budget, the next budget, which, by the way, they kept asking him, what's the most important thing we could or should be doing? He said, get us budget bills done on time. But he also talked about how critical the need is for this funding for Ukraine. And it's well past due. And he reminded people the vast majority of the funding is going to businesses in the United States. And I heard a Republican talking about that the other day as if it was news. In any case, do their jobs, get it done.
It is something that we've been discussing most of this week, which is the fact that with Israel and our assistance when the Iranian drone attack happened, that there was an article earlier that we were referring to and had referenced a couple of times regarding Ukraine feeling alone.
Absolutely.
This. And so we've discussed this a lot this week, and yet it still continues to be an issue for many House Republicans as to, well, for a better term, coughing up cash for Ukraine, which is and the reasoning on it to me really isn't all that well apparent. I don't even know what exactly the reasoning is, other than just it seems to be something that can hold up the president and hold up the speaker, and that's difficult to. I mean, if that's your only goal, I don't know what you do.
You know, people are painting this as Mike Johnson's the night Mike Johnson became speaker. You know, that he stepped forward, and he realized the potential and his responsibilities. He's referring to Reagan. He's talking about how great America is. I say all that is hogwash. I think he went to Mar-a-Lago. He talked to Trump. They struck some deal. They've realized the political calculation if right. the Congress goes on another, they need to find another leader. They probably can't even find anybody within that 400-plus member body that would want to do it. And Trump told them, go ahead, we've got your back. Yeah, Marjorie might be out, and you know, but the Democrats will step forward and save your speakership. I totally support funding for Ukraine, and I am incredibly upset that the Republicans have not articulated a good reason why they are against funding for Ukraine. But the idea that Mike Johnson has finally found a spine, I find ridiculous.
But did he really say, I mean, Trump may have said to Johnson, go ahead, we've got you back. But then what's he saying to Marjorie Taylor Greene? Because right. you know she's talking to him. So he's...
He's saying, Marjorie, you can be Marjorie.
We need to hear the voices of the reasonable here, the members of Congress who understand the global implications of what's going on. And if you ever want evidence about why Donald Trump should not be president again, all this machinations and equivocations that are putting our country and the world at risk is yet another example of it. Sorry to,
no,
to
don't be
go
sorry.
And interrupt you. But Trump... Sure, Trump said something for 5 minutes down in Mar-a-Lago. What were they there to talk about? They were there to talk about, you know, disruption of the upcoming election in the U.S., right? And then maybe he says, go ahead. But Marjorie Taylor Greene's not doing this on her own. And why don't they diminish her power? Raise up some of the voices of the common sense Republican members of Congress who understand the short and long-term implications of their inaction.
Marjorie Taylor Greene is appealing to the base. She's solidifying the base that, yep, we hear you on Ukraine. We're support you on Ukraine. They're doing two things at once.
Because you know the moment, and I want to get to Mark here, but and you know the moment that those individuals come forward, if they were to come forward, that the first thing you're going to hear out of former President Trump's mouth is RINO, Republican in name only.
So, you know.
Well, I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying I think that's what they're dealing with and trying to those Republican House members who need to get elected this fall are thinking about their futures as well.
Primary season's over. You know,
you're tough.
Just
all right.
Go do your job. Go do your job. Primary season's over.
Mark, we have 2 minutes, although if you need more time, we can do it on the other end of the break.
All right. Well, just give me a warning. But you talked about the first three aid bills for the countries at war under threat. And then the other two sort of Republican bills. It reminds me of the Star Wars films. The first three movies were clearly about good and evil. And the triumph of the galactic force promoting humanity in the end. The next two movies, frankly, were cringeworthy and tinged with racism and xenophobia. So there we are. If you take those five bills in order, they bear an interesting resemblance. The costs of... Look, I'm inclined to applaud Johnson for his latest action, which is trying to get these through. I think you have to realize that the costs have been severe. The Ukrainians, because of their... dwindling military inventories, particularly in terms of anti-missiles, in terms of air protection, have probably lost civilians to Russian attacks while we've been dithering.
In the last 24 hours.
Yeah, and despite what Tom Cotton and some other people who I think view this very foolishly have said, much of our deterrence with respect to China and Taiwan is irreparably harmed. There is the part of that deterrence historically rested on the possibility that the United States would actually enter a shooting war between China and Taiwan. The United States has proven itself incapable of even boxing up arms and sending them over to the Ukraine. Having seen that, China's going to make the right conclusion, which is until our politics dramatically change, we will not have the stomach to get involved directly in Taiwan. So we've already baked that cake. And I'll get to some of the other issues in a moment. So, Joe, I had started by saying that I think Johnson deserves some credit, but first we have to assess the costs of the delay. I'd also caution Johnson and the isolationists amongst the Republicans. I tell them a little story. I went through the FDR Museum over the weekend, and you look at the pictures of the America First Committee meetings, and just to clue the Republicans in, those guys are now, in retrospect, considered the bad guys. So a little historical perspective is not going to be kind. The issue about U.S. expenditures into Ukraine, I think this thing about, oh, we produce the arms here, so this really benefits America, is a little bit of a stretch. Actually, it's a weak economic argument. But I think there's even a better argument, which is this is an extraordinarily inexpensive investment in the security of our allies and our own and our own country. And I think that's the big miss here, not the fact that some people are employed building them here, but rather the fact that this is just such a cheap way to denigrate the Russians, to burnish our credentials as a country and the credentials of our alliance. That's really where I think we should focus. Johnson's come to a point where he's basically had to call the question on his leadership. He's basically said, if I put this forward, I might lose my speakership and I'm going to roll the dice. And I think he's to be congratulated for that. It sounds to me like he's already been working in league with the Democrats to get this done. I heard Nancy Pelosi last night on CNN praising him for a clever parliamentary move. So I suspect they sent her out as opposed to obviously Hakeem Jeffries would be a more explicit endorsement. But I think there's something afoot, and congratulations to them if they are working this out. I think the forces that Marjorie Taylor Greene represents need to be understood fully. She is now reportedly espousing a couple of theories, one of which is that Ukraine is rife with Nazis. The other was this quote that they're murdering priests and they're anti-Catholic in the Ukraine. She literally is repeating talking points that it's, at least in the reports I read, that they could trace back to Russian troll farms and Russian propaganda. I just wonder the intelligence of someone like that and the rest of the Berserker Conference. But look, I think it's clear the United States has come to a point where we need to get on with supporting our allies around the world. Johnson's calling the question. I hope he survives, but I think it's far more important that the Ukrainians and our other allies benefit from this. And if he's a casualty, then so be it. And I'll applaud him a bit for trading his job for Western values throughout the world.
But it's highly unlikely that if she, you know, I think it's true that they need to call the question, but I think that it's highly unlikely that he's going to lose his speakership, because I think enough House Republicans do not want to go to the chaos of another 15 rounds of votes. Who's waiting in the wings to take the job? Who's going to take the job? And they feel like he's doing a good enough job. The majority of the majority do. And I think that because he has such a close majority, if he moves these bills,
there will be enough Democrats who come over and vote for him. Maybe the others vote present. Maybe they vote for him en masse. I don't know. That'll be a strategy that they'll work out. But I don't think that the changing the House leadership now is in anyone's interest, and there'll be a way to work that out. So it likely doesn't happen. I could be wrong, but I do think that, again, the rest of the world is watching. These are very precarious times. This is signaling weakness. And I don't think Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing this on her own. I think she's doing it in close conversation with Trump. She talks all the time about how she talks all the time with Trump. I don't think if he said don't do this, I don't think she would be doing it. And I think that that's a reminder of his calculations and of whose interest he's working for. I mean, for him, it's all a political calculation. Can you weaken Biden to strengthen him? But we shouldn't be worrying about weakening Biden or Trump. We should be worried about weakening the U.S. position in the world. And we should be worrying about what's happening in the Ukraine, what's happening to people in Gaza, what's happening with our, you know, in Israel. That should be the focus of Trump.
We have letters. Christopher says, I disagree with Mark about America not protecting Taiwan. TSMC creates, TSMC stands for?
It's the big microchip company that now produces the vast bulk of the high-capability microchips.
And they're based?
In Taiwan. They've been historically considered, there's a word in Mandarin that means a mountain that can be used as defense, and they've effectively referred to that company as the natural defense of Taiwan historically. Go ahead, Joe.
TSMC creates the vast majority of semiconductors that we use in our daily lives and industries. When the chips are down, we will defend that, at least until we have the manufacturing capabilities stateside.
I don't think that's right. I think if you can't get the Americans to box up rifles and send them to Ukraine, there's no way that you're going to get Americans to suffer what are going to be catastrophic military costs if we take the Chinese on directly. But the letter writer is to be congratulated for their subtlety, because what they realize is that the United States now, part of this CHIPS Act, is basically the government and industry saying, boy, it sure stunk to have those businesses right stuck in Russia when we decided we weren't going to do business with them anymore. We need to get this high-capacity microchip production out of Taiwan as quickly as we can.
So into the U.S.
Into the United States, and some of our allies are doing the same thing. As to whether or not, in a way, I think actually the point's moot, because I think the next 4 or 5 years, China's learned enough from the Ukraine, and they've got enough work to do with their own military capabilities that they wouldn't pull the trigger, or they wouldn't launch an attack for a while anyway. Time's on their side, particularly, by the way, when you think about it from the Chinese political perspective. They think in much, much
longer
horizons than we do. But I think we've answered the question for the Chinese for the foreseeable future as to whether or not we'd get involved. And the answer is not under our current political conditions, would we?
But I do think it's important that the Biden administration is taking the leadership on growing at as fast as pace as possible the chips manufacturing in the U.S. and reshoring that. And I think Senator Schumer should also be applauded for his leadership in that issue.
By the way, it's Taiwanese Semiconductor Manufacturing Company.
Excellent. Thank you.
Good letter. Thank you for sending it.
Yeah, it's a great letter.
We go to Mary Beth. Mike Johnson needs to do his job and bring the full $95 billion Senate bill to the House for a vote. $95 billion is fully 1% of the total U.S. defense budget. $95 billion out of $895 billion. No one in the Senate or House gets everything they want. It's called compromise. Where are the party whips? What happened to getting your conference in line? Damn the torpedoes. Bring the bill back to the floor for a vote. Our allies are looking at us like we are a second-rate country. If we don't help Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel, our friends, our country is getting in very thin ice. Turn away from the extremists. The country is watching, which is a statement you have made. a few times already today.
Well, one of the things I wonder about is the speaking of the House leadership, where is Congresswoman Elise Stefanik in all of this? She represents a pretty extensive, you know, her constituencies are a lot of military bases.
She's grilling college presidents.
I understand that.
Yes.
Thank you. That was interesting yesterday, her. Not necessarily in a good way. But the letter writer is correct. And, you know, where is the Republican leadership? Where is she on this issue of maintaining the U.S. strength, doing what's right for the U.S., doing what's right on a for global perspective? Given her various roles on committees and her leadership position, she should know better. But again, I think where she is on the phone with Donald Trump. And we need, this is a time where we need real leadership. This is, the world's on fire. They need to move, send some stronger signals about the U.S. role in the world.
Teresa Bourgeois on the roundtable panel on Thursday, April 18th. We'll return with the final segment of this morning's show after this break. Welcome back to the roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, April 19th, we had a special panel live from the Linda, WAMC's Performing Arts Studio, and Joe Donahue was joined for the conversation by Bennington College faculty member, former EPA regional administrator, and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Ank, Siena College professor of comparative politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Albany Law School professor of law and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson.
We wanted to do a panel with all women this morning because there's so many issues that we're going to talk about today where women are really leading the charge. And I would just like to begin with each panelist talking a little bit about their own efforts. So, since Earth Day is Monday, let me begin with Judith Ank.
I want to write a whole book on this topic because we would not have clean air and clean water if not for women's leadership, mostly at the grassroots level. I'm so privileged to work with community people all over the country, and the leadership from women is extraordinary. And it's a different type of leadership. It's people who get stuff done, women who are like really thinking ahead. I kind of reject the notion of like women cleaning the earth and all that, no. But whether it's global issues or local issues, women are leading the way. And also if you look at the history of the environmental movement, Rachel Carson, of course, who wrote Silent Spring, Lois Gibbs from Niagara Falls, who lived at Love Canal, and because of Lois Gibbs and her neighbors, we have the federal Superfund law, Greta Thunberg, the young climate activist. But more importantly, I want to name women in our region who are leading the way on shutting the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator in Cohoes, which is temporarily closed. And a great Earth Day gift would be if they announced it was going to permanently close because it's poisoning the region. Pollution from cement plants, landfills. And then the issue that I spend most of my time on is plastics. And the gender gap on the plastics issue is unbelievable. I would say 95% of the activism is with women who are passing plastic bag bans and raising concerns about microplastics in food, microplastics in our body. Microplastics has been identified in the human heart, in blood, in breast milk, in the human placenta, both the maternal side and the fetal side. And women are really zeroing in on those issues. So our earth is not clean enough, but it would be much dirtier if not for the role of women. And these are mostly, so here's a trend. These are mostly women who don't get paid to do this work. It is unpaid.
Oh, it's like being a panelist.
It's unpaid. It's unpaid labor. And for that, we are just so grateful. And final point, I didn't say this, but it's on my bumper of my car. Well-behaved women rarely make history.
Libby Post.
You know, women in politics is a relatively, in some respects, new phenomenon. When I was a kid, and I'm 66, we didn't see that many women running for office at all on Long Island. And now we're seeing a plethora of women running for lots of different positions. And in Albany County, where I do the bulk of my work, Joanne Cunningham from Bethlehem is now the chair of the Albany County Legislature. We have Kathy Sheehan, who's a woman, obviously, who's the mayor of the city of Albany. There are other women throughout this area. Women's leadership is so crucially important. You know, Judith said something about not women not cleaning up the earth. I mean, women are, however, cleaning up politics as best as they can. And it's really an important thing to do. So I lobby not for women. I lobby for all the animal shelters in the state of New York. So I lobby for puppies and kittens, right? Which is the last bastion of nonpartisanship, I have to say. I used to say libraries and puppies and kittens, but not so much libraries anymore. But women are protecting our libraries, okay? And people who understand how important libraries are to our communities are protecting our libraries. But women's leadership has been something that has been really important to me, and I have to recognize the women in my life who have helped me cut my teeth in all of this. And that those are people like Shirley Gordon, who ran Family Planning Advocates for years, and I worked there, right? Gloria DeSole, who is the Affirmative Action Officer and much, much more at the University of Albany, and a wonderful friend. My mother, who was not political, but worked from the time I was 6 years old and was the breadwinner in our family because my dad got hurt. You know, so I saw powerful women, I continue to see powerful women, and it's really important for us to stand up, for women to stand up, and the flip of that is for men not to be threatened by that, because that's what happens. Look at the response to Taylor Swift, right, at the Super Bowl or wherever she was. Look at that response towards her. She's a powerful woman. She's the music, I guess, is okay. I don't really listen to it.
She's just released a new album at midnight last
right,
two,
right,
two
right.
albums.
Sarah does. Right. But nonetheless, she
Sarah's
is
Sarah's already listened to them.
Yeah, I know she has. She's using her bully pulpit, right? She really is. She's getting younger folks to get engaged in politics and to vote, which is really important. And she's been really clear about who she would like to see reelected. Women in politics, women in power is taking lots of different shapes and forms these days. I agree with some, I don't agree with others. I mean, that's part of our pluralistic society. It's part of being in a democracy. We can still disagree with one another, you know, but I think women have set a standard in terms of how to treat one another. We started Capital Women here, which is a local PAC to support pro-choice, pro-LGBT candidates. What I do, I love it. People think I'm nuts, but I really love what I do. And it's been incredibly rewarding to put good people in office and get good legislation passed.
Vera.
So many of you know that I teach international relations, Middle East, Latin America, and I know we have some other people here talking about immigration. So I'm going to take us to the Middle East in recognition of a particular women's movement that we used to pay a lot of attention to, but we're no longer doing that at the moment, which is the Kurdish women's movement, Woman, Life, Freedom, right? We had Jina Mahsa Amini a couple years ago being murdered by the Iranian Basij because she got off a bus from the Kurdish region and her veil was slipped back just a tad and showed some hair. The morality police went after her, beat her brutally, and she died in custody. Ever since, women in Iran, even though this movement was started a decade earlier in other Kurdish regions, women in Iran picked up this mantle of fighting for equality. While currently we don't pay any attention to the women in Iran, they're still on the streets. They're still protesting. They're still taking off their veils. A year and a half ago, I was in Berlin, and I participated in the largest demonstration of my life. 800,000 people gathered in Berlin to march against this Iranian regime and to demand women's equality. It was amazing who all came from all over the world to participate in this march. So what I'm saying now is, let's think of Jina Mahsa Amini and her sacrifice, of all the women that are marching in Tehran and other cities of Iran and in Kurdish regions, in Turkey, in Syria, in Iraq, to demand equality. Those women, despite the laws on the books and despite the morality police, are taking off their veils. They're cutting their hair publicly because they have been told to have long hair because that is a sign of femininity. And they've been told to hide their bodies under the chador. And they're not wearing it. They're walking around with hair they have cut off, and they've burned their veil publicly. And as we focus on the potential for widening the war in the Middle East, let's think of women and their incredible sacrifices. They're marching by the tens of thousands with their brothers and fathers and uncles in support of them. What they are sacrificing is incredible, and they're sacrificing their lives and their health and their futures to create a better world for all women that walk this earth.
Sarah Rogers.
I'm going to leave the immigration to Sienna, but I want to talk a little bit about women in the law, right? Women are now in the majority in law schools, slight. It's pretty evenly split, but there are more women in law school. There are more women entering the profession. The problem remains that women still earn far less than men in this profession. And women are not able to advance to partnership or to higher echelons of the legal profession at the same rate that men are, which doesn't match the statistics around who's going to law school. So there's still work to be done. In Albany, we are lucky enough to have graduated Kate Stoneman, who was the first woman to be admitted to the New York State Bar, but she had to sue in order to sit for the New York bar exam. She had to sue, I'm going to say it again, to be able to take the bar exam after already going to law school and doing all of the work. We have a strong tradition in this region of promoting these powerful women and drawing inspiration from them. When I was younger, I also had the benefit of participating in a program called Girl State, and there's a documentary out right now about it that is just fantastic. I cried the whole time because I was a 16-year-old girl again, learning about government, caring about my country, wanting to be a good patriot, growing up in the Midwest. And there's also a documentary about Boys State because it's segregated by gender. It's a program basically like a camp for government nerds. And I've been one since I was 10 years old. So I used to beg my parents to stay up to watch Ronald Reagan give the State of the Union address. It was like my favorite night of the year. So Girls State was my thing. And those programs are really important. But spoiler alert, what they found out was that the Girls State program was underfunded relative to the Boys State program. And that's recent. That's like last year. So there's work to be done, but I'm with Libby. I don't love the gender binary generally. I'd like to live in a future where we're not talking about that because I'm raising two boys. And when I went to the Barbie movie, I didn't feel as celebratory as a lot of other women because I actually want to live in a post-Barbie reality where men can have leadership qualities that are deemed to be female and not be ostracized as a result, because we need them. We need each other. And the gender spectrum is getting more and more complicated. So as that complicates the issue, people feel more and more torn. Like, am I these qualities and does that mean something about who I am as a person? No, we should focus on who people are as leaders, what qualities we want to see in our future, how we want to work cooperatively together. And because those have been traditionally seen as female or women qualities, it excludes other men who might have those qualities but don't feel welcome in those spaces. So I just want us to get sort of beyond the gender binary at some point in my lifetime, which is not going to happen, but maybe for my kids. And I want to model that for them.
Wonderful. Sienna Freeman Tolbert.
Yes, it's like Sarah and I teamed this up. So I'm going to narrow the focus down because women are important on our bar, but immigration specific. Because we deal with different cultures, I find that having female attorneys, having female immigration judges is very impactful. When a family's sitting in front of you and they're from a different culture, they may be from the Middle East or somewhere else, and I'm listening to the father tell his story of persecution, and I look at the mother and I can see her head is down, maybe she has a story of persecution. Personally, I've found multiple instances where the mother has a more stronger case because she's experienced female genital cutting or something more extreme like that. And we have to give them the comfortable space to speak to us, but they won't speak to my male counterpart all the time. Sometimes they're more comfortable speaking to me and I have to ask the father to leave the room, or we might just want to talk to the daughters. And it's important also on at the bench level to have that sensitivity as well, to say, hey, can we do this in a way that she doesn't have to discuss the domestic violence that she experienced, the physical violence that she experienced on the bench? Is there a way for you to take her statement into account as testimony? Those sensitivities matter when you're adjudicating these types of sensitive persecution asylum cases. So having women on the bench has been, in the bar and on the bench, has been extraordinary. And being able to ask your case to be moved to a certain judge because of sensitivities is important. I would also like to highlight that this is Black Maternal Health Week. And I would like to, I feel this very closely, and I think I want to honor all the women that have spoken out about their personal stories to make this into an issue. Someone had to say it first. Someone had to explain what happened to them in the back of their OBGYN room for this to become an issue. And so I really want to honor all of those women that spoke up. And now doctors have to undergo special training, sensitivities. You feel more comfortable speaking up and out against your challenging, I should say, your OBGYN when they say, you should be fine, go home, it's not a big deal. You're like, I think it is a big deal. I saw this doctor on TikTok that said, I should ask you this. So, I mean, you feel more empowered, and that's important. So I really wanted to honor and highlight Black Maternal Health Week as well.
Terrific. Nick Rangel.
I guess I just want to say I have the distinct pleasure of being raised by an Army vet. My mom was in the military, and she ran a tight ship, and she's here, and I just want to say hi. So, you know, I started
in the back. Go, Mom.
I started out with a very, very strong female lead in my household, and, you know, she was relentless in her, you know, education that women are just as strong, just as capable, and should take up space and should be at the table and should speak up, and gosh, I have no problem speaking up. So, and then, you know, the last three deans at Albany Law School have been women, have been excellent, strong leaders. And I was at Albany Law School as a student and then on staff under female leadership there. So I did see strong female leads in law school. And then I went to work for Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, where I spent almost 10 years and recently left as a second deputy counsel. And I will say that when the Democrats took the Senate majority, there was a seismic shift in what leadership looked like in state politics. Not only did the Democratic conference have far more women in Senate positions, but leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins is powerful. I mean, there is no way around that, right? And you can see that her priorities changed conversations in New York State in every area of law that matters to people, right? Child care vouchers expanded exponentially. Education investments are more equitable and more deeply felt at all levels of education. Homelessness has been tackled. There's been a five-year housing plan under the previous governor and the current governor, and billions of dollars invested into eviction prevention, development of new affordable housing, and a number of other programs, and the investment in elder and disability care has been unmatched. So I could go on a whole list, but that change in politics is felt every single day by everybody in this room. And so much of that is due to the fact that there were women in those rooms negotiating and leading the charge on many of those pieces of legislation. My predecessor at Legal Aid Society for Northeastern New York is Lillian Moy. She is known as a powerhouse in the community. She has led many, many important conversations around race equity in the law. And I'm very proud to continue to carry that torch for legal services. We serve low-income and vulnerable populations across 16 counties, and legal services for every single person who needs representation in a life-changing case, like their eviction, their divorce, their custody, their disability claim. All of these things are critically important in the law, and is so important to make sure that we have access to. So,
Judy Patrick.
I spent 40, 45 years in local journalism, local daily journalism. I actually would call Judith Hank once in a while because I would write environmental stories and she was a great source. But the media has historically been male dominated. I mean, the name Nellie Bly comes to mind, but that was the exception, not the rule. When I started in daily newspapers back in the 70s, men covered City Hall, hard news, women covered engagements, features. Sometimes we would cover consumer stories. That has changed. You will see more women covering hard news, City Hall, the White House, the state legislature. And I want to tell you why that's important, because when you have a woman pushing a story or pitching a story, or you have a woman deciding what story goes on A1, you get a different mix than you did back when only men were at the table. I was the first female managing editor at my paper, the first editor at my paper, and I can tell you that it brings a whole different way of approaching a story. When I'm there, I can ask, aren't there any women you could have interviewed for this story? Isn't there another perspective? Shouldn't we be more careful about how we handle the young victim in this case? So those are the kinds of issues that have developed over time. But let me make it clear, it's not equal at this point, especially in this age of social media. Women reporters are more and more apt to be harassed, dangerously harassed online, with the most vile kind of criticisms. And so they need protection. My job now at the New York Press Association, I support the hundreds of local newspapers that are still out there working and producing good journalism every week, every day. And many of those local newspapers are owned by women, strong women that are sticking with it during a very, very tough time. And they need the support that we provide at the Press Association by providing education, feedback, training, and support. We really work hard to promote open government and transparency in government, and it remains an issue to this day. We fight the state legislature to open laws about freedom of information laws and getting access to the important documents we need to make decisions as citizens. So these issues about women in the media, it's about story selection, story choice, and it's also clearly about protecting all the journalists out there, but especially being mindful of women journalists and what they have to endure just to do their jobs.
Judy Patrick on the Roundtable panel on Friday, April 19th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are posted online at WAMC.org. They're also in the WAMC app, or you can find them via podcast. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.